America has a history of oppressing people of color. It's most often blamed on systemic racism. That's the term most often used in Black Lives Matter protests against the police and the justice system. But Isabel Wilkerson says that doesn't do justice to a social construct that's older than the very idea of race or racial difference. She's talking about the ancient system of caste in India, with an echo in Nazi Germany. Wilkerson is a Pulitzer Prize-winning veteran of the New York Times, author of The Warmth of Other Suns, which won a National Book Award for tracing America's internal migrations during the 20th century. Her latest book is Caste, The Origin of Our Discontents. Isabel Wilkerson, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me. Thanks.
So caste, that's the title of the book, of course, and that's the term you prefer to systemic racism. That's a term most often associated with India. So how does it apply to the United States?
Well, it goes back to, in some ways, the work that I did with the Warmth of the Suns, in which I was studying essentially the infrastructure of the world that the people were fleeing, 6 million African Americans fleeing the Jim Crow South. And I decided, and after speaking to over 1,200 people and also looking into what had been written before about that era, I emerged from the research with the word caste as opposed to the word racism. The word racism does not appear in the book, and that's because racism did not seem sufficient to capture what they had endured in a world where it was against the law for a Black person and a white person to merely play checkers together. There were actually separate Bibles in courtrooms throughout the South. That meant that the very word of God was segregated in that era. And so there was something more to it than that. That essentially caste is an artificial, arbitrary, graded ranking of human value in a society. And that is what I discovered when writing The Warmth of the Suns. And now this book allows me and all of us to go deeper into what is essentially an unseen hierarchy, an unseen infrastructure of our divisions. And so that's how I came to the use of the word caste.
When you describe Jim Crow, it seems to me it is not something that is taught, at least very effectively, in high schools and in college even in the United States. Tell us a little bit more about it and how it resembled the caste system of India, for example, since India, once again, is the paradigm for a caste system.
Oh, you're absolutely right. In fact, after The Warmth of the Suns came out, and it's been 10 years since it's been out, one of the things that people more commonly say to me over and over and over again is, I had no idea. People who actually lived through the era said that they had no idea of how extensive, how organized, how embedded this ranking and hierarchy and infrastructure was in the American South, which was essentially the basis for hierarchies that then extended beyond the South with the Great Migration as they fled and went to other parts of the country. It seemed as if these assumptions and this hierarchy carried forth wherever they went. And so that in a hierarchy such as this, there, you know, one's birth into a caste system indicates where you fit in the caste system. In other words, whatever metric is used, some caste systems use religion, some use ethnicity, some use geography, and here the use of the measure for where one fits in a caste system would be what you look like, the random characteristics that we now call race. And so what they were experiencing was a world in which everything that they could and could not do was based upon what they look like. One's standing, respect, benefit of the doubt, access to resources, assumptions of competence and beauty, even through no fault of anyone's own, would be the determining factor of so much of what you could do in that caste system, no matter where you fell on that. So one example of the restrictions that were on them that had to be carefully followed would be spatially. In other words, if an African-American in the Jim Crow South was walking and they passed a white person on the street, they would have to yield no matter what, but they also might have to step off a sidewalk. They'd have to walk into the side doors or the back doors of whatever business establishment that they were going to, if a white business or white home. They had to be careful at every step of the way. African-American drivers could not even pass a white motorist on the road, no matter how slowly they were going. So these were the the written and unwritten rules and laws and expectations and customs that they had to live under. And any breach of that caste system could literally mean their lives. So there are parallel examples in India of the severe, almost unimaginable restrictions that were facing the what are now known as Dalits, but had previously been known as untouchables, people whose very touch could be seen as polluting to those who were deemed dominant in the caste system of India. And so there are parallels and points of intersection in these two hierarchies.
In a caste system, separate from the United States for the moment, is it possible for example, an untouchable in India to actually rise out of the caste or of the layer in the caste that they've been born into higher levels?
That is such a great question. Thank you for asking. I've had so many interviews, and this is the first time I've been asked that. Thank you. Yes, that's one of the things that is most confounding when we talk about a caste system. You know, you think about the caste on an arm that you play, that the mechanism that's placed to hold fractured bones in place. One of the things that characterizes a caste system is that they're fixed and embedded roles and that people are assigned to on the basis of where they are born into that caste system. And yet, in both the United States and in India, the originating most easily recognizable caste system in the world, in both cases, there are always exceptions to the rule. In fact, one of the people who was a person who was born to the lowest caste in India, born an untouchable, or now known as Dalit, rose to the level of being a prime minister there. There are many Dalits who have become professors, physicians, barristers. I mean, they are people who have risen to the highest levels, but it's a great effort. These are often exceptions to the general rule, and they are people who are often of extraordinary skill and talent and fortitude and perseverance, who are able to transcend the barriers that had been historically placed in the path of their ancestors and of them as well. And the same goes, of course, here in the United States, where we are aware of so many African Americans who have transcended these barriers to become leaders in often in entertainment and in sports and in music and in the arts. So there are exceptions in both societies.
Well, and of course, we have Barack Obama becoming the president of the United States. So even though that happened, that doesn't mean necessarily then that the caste analysis doesn't apply.
No, absolutely, it does apply. I mean, I think that one way of seeing it is to think of caste as the bones, race as the skin, and class as the clothes, diction, accents, education, achievements that we have some control, a person has some control over. And one way of looking at it is to think about if you can act your way out of it, then it's class. But if you cannot act your way out of it, it's caste. And so there's an example of this editor at British Vogue, for example, who was would be considered among the best dressed humans maybe on the planet. He happens to have been of African descent, Afro-Brit, and he was walking into office building, and he was told by the security guard to go and use the freight elevator. This has happened just maybe a month or so ago. He was told to use the freight elevator of his own building. He was the editor of the magazine, told to use the freight elevator of his own building. And so that's an example. There are many, many examples of people who have been assigned historically to what would be considered the bottom of the caste system, bottom of the ladder or the hierarchy, and yet they succeed and persevere and rise to high levels in terms of class, but then in an instant can be reduced or returned to or reminded of the perception of where society has placed them historically at the bottom of a hierarchy such as ours.
So you're suggesting then that even though we see what appears to be progress, in the case of Barack Obama, for example, and now we have a woman of African, not only she's a woman, but African descent and also South Asian descent becoming a vice presidential nominee. That's not necessarily an indication of progress?
Well, it is an indication of progress, but it is not an indication of the dismantling of the hierarchies that lead to people having to, still face the assumptions and stereotypes and other restrictions that are in place no matter how far they rise. You see the pushback that President Barack Obama received while he was president. Many, many people made note of attacks that questions, about his birth and his citizenship and that sort of thing that did not necessarily happen to other presidents. And so there's the additional pushback and sometimes resistance to anyone who might transcend or break free or breach what would be the expected role of someone born to a certain place in the caste system.
How is it helpful in understanding America, though, to regard these things as the result of caste rather than as the result of race, since we seem to be very conscious of race?
Yeah. Well, one thing is that, speaking of the progress that you've described, progress that has been made at great cost to people who gave their lives and their souls to the civil rights movement, people of all backgrounds and races who fought for civil rights, human rights, you might say, in this country. When you think about how this is fairly new in our country's history, 400 years of the presence of people of African descent enslaved, originally, of course, enslaved upon arrival and enslaved for 246 years, and then followed by almost 100 years of Jim Crow segregation, hierarchy, caste system, however we describe it. So that the idea of African Americans truly being able to participate fully, not excluded from the mainstream of American life, this is a relatively new phenomenon. It's within the lifespan of many, many people alive today. We're going back only to the 1960s to come to a time where for the first time in our country's history, African Americans were really truly able to become participants in society. So what we're seeing is the manifestation of progress that has occurred since that time. But it's also a reminder that because we have had the progress, that means that many of the things that we're facing right now are not the classical open racism of our forefathers' era. We have to acknowledge that there has been progress. And yet, if there has been progress, why are we facing the upheaval, the divisions, the tensions, and then, of course, the rotation and bombardment of the videos that remind us that at any given moment, people who had been historically assigned to the bottom of the caste system, bottom of the hierarchy, can be going about their days, sitting at a Starbucks, and then someone calls the police on them, or someone could be, barbecuing in a public park in Oakland, and someone could call the police on them, or of course, the more wrenching examples of police brutality in which a person loses their life, unarmed people losing their lives on video, recorded for anyone to see around the world, these horrific instances that we've seen. Why are we seeing those things when the classical open racism of our forefathers' era is not what we actually live with today? People do not now, as they had in the past, openly proudly proclaim themselves to be racist. That is not the era in which we live. What is underneath what it is that we're seeing? There's something more powerful underneath that we are not seeing. And this is where I'm speaking about this underlying structure that, and you ask, what is the advantage of speaking of it this way? What can we learn from it? And that is that it frees us from the freighted language that can often bring in, seem to bring in emotion of guilt and shame and blame that comes with the language that we are familiar with. You can use language for so long that you almost can't hear it anymore. Having a new language of ways to think about ourselves, ways to see how we interact, ways of seeing how we have inherited this, that it's no one's fault. No one alive is responsible for the hierarchy that was created at the time that the country was founded, even before there was a country during the colonial era. And so, but we are now the inheritors of this hierarchy. And the question is, what do we do about it? caste gives us a framework for thinking about the structure of the divisions as opposed to the emotions of the divisions. And if we are able to separate ourselves from the emotions and look at the structure, I'm describing the country as an old house. And when you have an old house, you know that there are going to be things you have to deal with. As soon as you fix one thing, there's something else that's going wrong. There's always work to do. The work is never done. And then after a rain, you don't want to go into that basement. But if you don't go in the basement, it's at your own peril, because whatever is going on in the basement after rain, you'll have to deal with it whether you choose to look at it or not. It's not going to go away just because you choose not to look at it. Not knowing does not make that does not mean that there's not a problem. And so this is a goal. The goal of this work is to illuminate and to look at something that we otherwise would not see, like the joists and the beams in the houses that we live in. This is the internal unseen structure that we've inherited, and it's time to look at it because it is what is underneath what we thought we could see otherwise, but with, which also has not been dealt with.
Back very quickly to the issue of race. One of the things that stunned me about the book was when you tell the story of how there are no Black people in Africa.
Yes, that was told to me. That was a comment that was made to me by a playwright in Britain, who a Nigerian playwright who said this to me after I'd given the talk. And she said, you know that there are no Black people in Africa. And of course, to the American ear, it sounds that makes no sense. I mean, of course, there's an entire subcontinent of Black people. But these are terms that only had meaning. First of all, the idea of race as we currently understand it to be is a fairly new concept, only 500 years old or so, growing out of the transatlantic slave trade and the exploration of the rest of the world by European explorers. And so the idea of race is something that does not figure into identity until you are confronted with or having to move about with people who are presumed to be another race. So this is a creation of man, a creation of humanity. People who are from Africa do not have to think of themselves as Black when they are in their home countries, because they're surrounded by people who look more or less like them from the perspective of the United States. And they only become Black when they leave and go to a place where they are then in some ways positioned against, sadly, people who look different from them, because that is how the bipolar infrastructure and hierarchy that exists here has been created and actually works. And so it was an eye-opening comment to think about how we have been categorized randomly, arbitrarily, and artificially, and that it's the basis of these divisions that were created by man that have been the source of war, civil war, and upheaval that we are still wrestling with to this day.
Does this apply in the United States to people of color who aren't necessarily Black or descended from Africa?
Absolutely. I mean, in a bipolar caste system, which is what emerged from colonial Virginia, a caste system in which the people on top, the dominant group, were the English colonists themselves. And then they brought in people from Africa to work the land, to create a country for free. And this went on for 246 years for 12 generations. And so once these two poles were in place, then anyone else entering this caste system, this bipolar caste system, had to figure out a way to navigate between these poles. And when they arrived, it turned out, just as the Nigerian playwright was saying to me, that people arrived not thinking of themselves as Black or white, but then assigned to those categories once they arrived. So the people who were Hungarian or Polish or Irish had no reason to necessarily think of themselves as white. That wasn't the primary identifier for them, but upon arriving in the United States, that's what they were categorized as. And so much of our country's history, particularly since the late 19th century, has been one of curating what the population of the United States would look like. And that means anyone who did not come directly from Northern Europe had to figure out where they were going to fit in. And people who've come from other parts of the world, from Asia, from South and Central America, have had to also navigate this bipolar system in which they have to find themselves in the middle, what I might call the middle caste, people who are neither at neither of the poles, but then moving between and experiencing some of the advantage of being in the dominant caste, if they, a lot of it has to do with how one looks, or experiencing some of the, because race is based upon what one looks like primarily and how you're perceived to be, what you're perceived to be, and then experiencing the disadvantages if they are perceived as being closer to those who are at the bottom, who have been assigned to the bottom, meaning African American. So there's a constant navigation, negotiation, and an attempt to situate oneself, of course, also with the goal toward how do you survive and how do you succeed in a world, in a hierarchy that's pre-exists you, but that you have to find a way to succeed in and manage in.
Do we need to rewrite the history books? And is there a chance, if you think there is, that we should, that it might actually happen?
I think that there is a great need, as I learned from the book that I wrote, The Warmth of the Suns, where people said to me, you know, I had no idea of what had happened. I think it's so necessary for us as Americans to get on the same page about our country's history. There's so much that has not been told because so much of it did not include the voices of the people who had been silent, the voices of the people who had not been heard from. And the more we hear from the voices of others who have been participants in the building of this democracy but had not had their voices heard, the more that we hear from them and get the complete full story of our country's history, then I think we will be moving a step further toward, you know, somehow transcending the barriers that have been created to divide us.
The book is Caste, The Origins of Our Discontent. The author is Isabel Wilkerson. And Isabel, I wish that we had another hour or two to talk about this. We don't, but people can read the book. And thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you so much for having me.
The producer of To the Point is Andrea Brody. Our engineer is Chuck Prevetary. Other episodes are available on your favorite podcasting app. And if you want to reach us, we're on Twitter at tothepoint_KCRW. You can reach me directly at WarrenAlney1. If you want to learn more about our guests and what we've talked about on the podcast, visit our webpage. You can go to kcrw.com/shows and scroll down to The Point. You'll see links and details for all of our programs in our show notes. Thanks for being with us this time. Join us again.